This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, and thank you for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith, and we're standing here in what could reasonably be described as a fairly blustery BBC Aberdeen car park.
Yeah, we're expecting winds up to 100 miles an hour in Scotland this weekend. It's nothing like that at the moment, but the trees are really bent over. It's pretty wild.
If you're a keen mountain biker in Scotland, you'll know that Glentress Forest near Peebles is home to the Mountain Bike Centre of Scotland. Now, I was in the area recently and I thought I would pop in. It turned out to be a pretty opportune time to visit, as the Developing Mountain Biking in Scotland group had just had their biennial conference. I asked Graham McLean, who's project leader of the group, what came out of it.
We do know that we've had a tremendous success story in mountain biking in Scotland for a number of different reasons. The amount of trails we have, the access we have, the amount of businesses that we have involved in it now as well, the participation programmes, all a great success. But what does that look like into the future? We're currently working up a new strategy from 2019 to 2025, and we're looking for Scotland to be really known as the European home of mountain biking. A leader in our trail management, our trail development, I'm a leader in our sport development, our participation, and also in an industry and an innovation. What will that actually mean? Well, we want to get more people on the bikes. We want up to 2 million visits to the outdoors per annum on mountain bikes by 2025. We want to see the economic impact of mountain biking grow to be worth £408 million per annum. And we also want to see Scots achieving on the world stage through mountain biking and trying to have a mountain bike winner in the World Cup or the World Championships in every discipline by 2025.
Massively successful though it is, and hundreds of trails though there are, folk build their own, and that causes huge problems.
Yeah, that was a big thing that we launched at the conference, was a new guidance that we've developed working with the National Access Forum, looking at that unauthorised trails guidance. And a big part for us is developing mountain biking in Scotland has been actually to demonstrate these trails actually have a lot of benefit as well. They really kind of, they keep people engaged in the sport, they give them continued challenges. A lot of those athletes that we're talking about winning in the world stage will use these trails to develop their skills and develop their ability, and they're quite often harder and more challenging than the trails that we have here. And actually, because of that as well, and because more people are getting better at mountain biking, we've seen this, is that actually has tourism opportunities as well. But we do recognise that has management problems, and that's where Forestry Commission and Scottish Land and Estates presented a paper in January 2017 saying that this is an issue for them. What this guidance suggests, though, is a way of trying to bring those benefits together with looking to try and mitigate the concerns that landowners have around the environmental damage it can cause, the potential liability, particularly interacting with other users, and how if they get injured by somebody on these trails is an issue for them, and also the economic challenge that provides them as well, if they have to go and look at them, if they have to risk assess them, if they have to do the inspections. That's time for staff to do that, which then costs them money. So we have to look at ways of mitigating against that. I think our new guidance provides a way for mountain bikers to have discussions with landowners around these trails. Where should they go, and can we have the right trail in the right place and then managed by the right people? And that right people might be a partnership between mountain bikers and landowners. We've launched the guidance now. The new challenge is actually implementing that. We're really pleased that we have regional coordinators in the Tweed Valley and Aberdeenshire who are going to play a really crucial role in helping that mountain bike community come together bringing landowners on the table and trying to make this guidance actually turn into reality.
So my name's Ed Sheet, and I kind of look after developing mountain biking in the Tweed Valley.
And I'm Will Clark, I look after developing mountain biking in Aberdeenshire.
When you've got guerrilla mountain bike trail construction going on, you know, the landowners are bound to be worried about legal liability.
Yeah, it's true. The trails are kind of cropping up with more and more frequency because more and more people are riding them. Those riders are also going to the cafes and staying in the accommodation provision as well. So it's a huge part of the economy now, and it can't really be ignored. So it's finding a solution to how we manage them going forward.
But if I've got a bit of forestry and somebody comes along without my permission, without even speaking to me, and builds a trail, am I legally liable if they then fall off the bike?
Depends where it is. I mean, there's people have a really big responsibility to take care of themselves. That's really defined within case law. So there's no absolute around liability. What is clear is that people need to take responsibility for their own actions when they do things. If, however, that somebody's built a trail and it's sort of obviously apparent to the landowner that they can see risks from it, they do it, then they do have a duty of care to then act upon that.
Hang on, the landowner may not even be a mountain biker. That's not fair.
No, we agree with that. We see that. And what we'd like to encourage is for groups and mountain bikers to work with landowners, to speak to people before they go and build trails. So we want to encourage that discussion between things. There is those trails, we understand landowners won't do it, but if they can work with the mountain bikers, we can understand they might be angry at first, but wait, calm this down, we'll go, let's actually, how can we manage this? And a more proactive way to do it, rather than just shut it and end up with some sort of a way where the mountain bikers are putting it into an area where they really don't want it, where they might cause more environmental challenges. If they can actually go in the mountain biker and say, look, this is unacceptable, we can't have this here, but over here we can work with you on this bit here, that provides a better relationship and a better way forward in our eyes.
I think with myself and Ed in position in our two regions, we can help facilitate some of that discussion. And with this new guidance that we've produced, there's a document there for reference for both the landowners and the mountain bike community. And hopefully we can improve those relationships as we move forward.
You've got one in your hand. It's called Unauthorised Mountain Bike Trails, a guide for land managers and riders and things. But do you ever get land managers coming to you and saying, look, we'd actually quite like them in?
Yeah, absolutely we do. So my post's quite new in Aberdeenshire, and we have quite a lot of these type of trails. We have recently established a group called the Aberdeenshire Trails Association, and right away when we established that group, we were contacted by several land managers or landowners to see if the group could come and help them with some of the trails they have. And as Graham said, there's lots of economic opportunities around these trails as well. They're not necessarily always a problem trail. So we're looking forward to working with a lot of landowners in our region to try and improve the trails, make them more sustainable, make them safer, but also so the region can benefit from having them.
Nothing succeeds like success, but at times success can be a pain in the backside. Are you struggling to keep up with demand?
I think that's certainly the case in the Tweed Valley. We have a great trail network, but maintaining that trail network is a struggle, and there are groups of volunteers, but formalising that into a new Tweed Valley Trails Association has been a key part of my work in supporting them, basically doing the boring stuff so the volunteers don't have to, so looking into insurance for them, talking to landowners and trying to get those agreements in place where they can then coordinate their efforts. And social media is a powerful tool to get these groups out, and huge numbers of volunteers are keen to do it, but having the structure in place so they can is key. The other key part around that is getting them qualified as well. So we've held, I think, between myself and Will, across the country, there's 22 now qualified.
Yeah, 22 qualified, and we've got some more courses coming up in early 2019 as well. So we're developing that network of people who can maintain the trails and keep everything sustainable.
Will Clark, Mountain Bike Development Officer for Aberdeenshire, and we also heard Ed Sheet, Development Officer for Tweed Valley, and Graham McLean, Project Leader for Developing Mountain Biking in Scotland. Coming up shortly in the podcast, we're going to hear about cyclists on electric mountain bikes.
Yeah, we're cheating, going to that. It's not cheating because I'm slightly biased. But that whole
point... Don't tell me you've got one.
I've got one, yeah. Of course I've got
one. Of course you've got one. You've got everything.
It's not even Christmas yet.
Yeah, exactly.
That conflict, potential conflict between the bicyclists and the landowners is very real. Mm-hmm. And as it gets more and more popular, it's going to become more real because the landowners are convinced that if there's a structure there, a jump or whatever, somebody comes off, then they will be legally responsible.
Whether they know the jump is there or not.
Yeah.
See, that's interesting, because when I spoke to these guys, they seemed to suggest it was a grey area. Sometimes it was, sometimes it wasn't. But if under those circumstances, if it's a grey area in law, you're going to take the precautionary principle and say, well, you're just not getting it then.
Yeah.
Pure and simple.
You're just going to definitely keep yourself safe until somebody sorts the law out. But big subject.
Just earlier this week, we went up to an estate near Braemar called Mar Lodge. Now, about 20 years ago, it was taken over by the National Trust for Scotland. Prior to that, it had been a bog-standard Scottish shooting estate. It was a sporting estate. It was there for basically the grouse and the deer and everything else. But the National Trust for Scotland have been trying to do very different things with it.
Yeah, they took some big initiatives 20 years ago to reduce the deer population, to try and re-establish the forest, the natural forest. And then hopefully put the deer back in once the forest is established. So, as you say, we were up there, so I thought I'd get a wee update on what's happening.
My name is David Frew. I'm the operations manager here at Mar Lodge Estate, working for the National Trust for Scotland.
Okay, you know, here we are at the end of the year. How important is wildlife to the lodge and the estate?
Well, it's really central to everything we're doing here, I suppose. One of the major objectives at Mar Lodge Estate is woodland expansion, habitat restoration, and that's really all to benefit the species that depend on woodland, moorland, all the habitats that we've got here. So wildlife's kind of key to everything.
Well, take it back a wee bit, a couple of decades ago, because you'd done a power award, but what kind of state was the estate in at that point, from a wildlife point of view?
It was pretty depleted for a long time. The Victorian era, where hunting was really the primary concern above everything else, you know, that led to the loss and persecution and loss of a lot of species, a lot of iconic species, and it's taken a long time to recover, and it's still recovering. You know, we're certainly not there yet, but we're starting to see things change and improve.
Well, what do you still have to do?
Well, really, it's all about expanding habitats and getting habitats to connect. In our case, that's largely about woodland. There are a lot of fragments of ancient Caledonian pinewood around here, but they're all separate fragments. And the problem with that for wildlife is that they're all contained within those wee fragments, so they can't expand, populations can't grow and expand. So we're trying to connect up bits of woodland to allow that to happen and some of these rarer species to thrive.
But that's quite a long-term project, you know. That's not something you turn around in 5 years.
Yeah, I know. Well, our woodland plan, for example, is framed around a 200-year vision. You and I will be long gone before it comes to fruition, but we've got to start somewhere, so it's laying the groundwork for it.
Do you get a buzz out of that, or did you daunted by it?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of both, to be honest, but mainly it's a buzz. You know, it's thinking, it's not, as I say, it's not thinking about you and I, it's thinking about my kids, their kids in the future, it's the generations to come, so we're kind of trying to set things up for the future.
Lots of hard decisions. Obviously, deer have to be controlled if you want to restore forests. That's always an emotive thing.
Well, I think the first thing we've always got to be clear about is it's not about getting rid of deer. We can absolutely live with deer, and in fact, they're a really important part of what we do here. But in order to allow some of these habitats to recover, we do have to bring the deer numbers down, to give the trees a chance to get away. And then actually, we can let the deer back in. The deer are a woodland animal. They want to be there, and we need them to be there. So it's just a case of finding that balance.
That's one side, but you've had a major success this year.
Yeah, so another threatened species that returned to Mar Lodge Estate just 2 years ago, the hen harrier. Again, that's a species that historically was persecuted to extinction, more or less, in this part of the world, and is actually still incredibly rare in the UK. 2 years ago here at Mar Lodge, we had our first harrier nest in living memory. And this year that rocketed up to 7 harrier nests, and we actually fledged 24 hen harrier chicks, which is really just a remarkable story in the space of 2 years.
Is that something you've done?
It's not something we've consciously done, but again, it's all just part of this overall habitat improvement. And once the habitat gets a chance to recover, these rarer species will find it and will want to return. So that's really been what it's all about, and we're delighted. I mean, they nest in the springtime, so late April, May, June. So, yeah, 7 nests this year. That was a bit of a bumper year. We know it was a good vole year, so plenty of food for them. Whether or not we'll be as successful next year, we'll have to wait and see. But here's hoping it's all good at the moment.
David Frew, National Trust Operations Manager at Mar Lodge there. They've done big things. You know, when we went through the estate, it was looking fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's great. A lot of the trees are coming back. I wouldn't want to be up there today
No.
with this wind, which is just increasing by the minute at the moment.
Well, it's interesting. We've got quite big beech trees in the car park here. They are swaying about in an alarming manner, as is everything else. We've got a flagpole right at the far end there, where the BBC flag normally flies. Nation shall speak peace unto nation. Well, thankfully, it's not up today, because you can hear the halyard on that just hammering in the pole.
Yeah, I'm glad my boat's out the water, tucked up and safe, hopefully.
A few weeks ago, we brought you the story of how reindeer came to be in the Cairngorms. Now, the very same reindeer that, to be honest, if you've been just about anywhere in Scotland recently, when there've been something Christmassy themed, these things are trotted out. They're remarkable animals. The herd was introduced to the area 50 years ago without really any proper evaluation of the impact they might have on the ecosystem of the area. Well, a study's now underway to establish just what their impact might have been, and Ewan's been finding out more.
Reindeer are an important part of Christmas. The female reindeer, and it is only females who have antlers at this time of year, are harnessed to the back of Santa's sleigh for his big night, travelling the globe, delivering presents. They've evolved to be in perfect harmony with the tundra and forests of Arctic Scandinavia. But what about reindeer in Scotland? There's concern about the grazing pressure of this big animal on the sensitive ecological balance of the Cairngorms. So their future here is uncertain. The herd is owned by Tilly Smith.
La, la. La, la.
So what does la mean?
La, la means food up.
Right.
It's it sort of mimics the reindeer grunting, which is the noise they make.
You seem very at home in this environment. And they were here pre-Ice Age.
They were. And nobody really knows when they became extinct. But interestingly, the Vikings are thought to have hunted them in Caithness and Sutherland. Well, that's only 800 years ago.
Reindeer returned to Scotland in 1952, thanks to a Swedish couple, Mikael Utsi and Dr. Ethel Lindgren.
Mikael Utsi wooed the authorities during post-war, said they could perhaps be a source of meat for the Scottish nation. And so in 1952, the first small group came in. And this is the descendants from them.
Tilly's hopeful the study will confirm her belief that the reindeer are not harming the environment.
We're already pretty canny about how many reindeer we keep, and we've always been very sensitive about making sure the reindeer aren't impacting on the ground. Reindeer are always on the move, always wandering around. They have lovely big flat feet which don't trample the ground. And they're quite fastidious eaters, a little bit here and a little bit there. Okay. You could feed one if you want. They're lovely to hand feed.
They're quite gentle.
Well, they've got completely furry noses.
Wow.
They've got no top front teeth, so they can't bite you even if they wanted to.
It's just the antlers you've got to worry about.
It is just the antlers. They've got some headgear there.
And those female reindeer are impressive. Perfect for pulling Santa's sleigh, because frankly, the males are not up to the job. Not only do they lose their antlers in winter, they also lose most of their body fat, whereas the females weigh in with 50% body fat, keeping them warm and full of energy. Throw in the fact they can see in the ultraviolet and have amazing night vision, they are perfect for lands where the sun never rises. Great, as I've said, for the far north, but what about the hills above Aviemore? Well, about to contend with those massive antlers is Dr. Louise de Rad from the University of the Highlands and Islands. She's monitoring the reindeer to get a really detailed indication of where they roam, what they eat, and how much. So tell me about the project. What are you trying to do?
Well, a large part of the Cairngorms is being managed for landscape restoration and reforestation, and the red deer population is being quite carefully managed. But yet here we have these beautiful reindeer who free range in the Cairngorm for a large part of the year. And we're trying to find out what their role in the ecosystem is.
This is a limited study with the idea of expanding the research so that a final decision on the future of reindeer in the Cairngorms can be decided on facts rather than speculation. So, armed with a laptop and a screwdriver, Louise heads off up the hill. First thing, catch a reindeer with a collar.
Good boys.
They're looking great.
They are. They're looking in their fine condition at this time of year, Ewan.
So what's the plan for today? What are we doing?
We're going to find our reindeer that's wearing collar at the moment, and we're going to take that off, and we're going to download the data that we've collected so far, and then from that we're going to start our data analysis.
So what kind of data are you getting from these collars?
They've got a GPS sensor on them that tells us where they're going. All that data is being sent through satellite, so I can just see it from behind my desk even. Then there's accelerometer data that tells us what they're doing in what places. And then there's also a camera sitting at the bottom, and that tells us a bit more about what they're feeding on and their interactions.
Is this a dangerous business? Because these are pretty sharp. Sorry.
If you don't touch them, and as long as Tilly's here, we'll be okay.
Right, so in and out quickly.
Yes.
Dr. Louise Durad and Tilly Smith with the Cairngorm Reindeer. When she said, we're going to catch some reindeer and I've got a screwdriver, I thought, what?
Yeah.
How do you catch a reindeer with a screwdriver?
Well, you catch the reindeer, which is remarkably simple, because they just walk up to you.
You just unwrap the Mars bar and say, eat this.
Yeah, and the screwdrivers for taking the collar off, obviously. But it is tricky, because they do look around in an interested sort of a way, and they've got 3 feet of antler.
Yeah.
They could do a bit of damage.
What always surprised me with the reindeer is how small they are.
Yeah, about the size of a St. Bernard dog.
Yeah.
A bit slimmer. Beautiful, beautiful animals. They're just gorgeous.
Yeah, lovely eyes. And anyway, let's go back to Glentrest, the Mountain Bike Centre of Scotland. One of the items on the agenda at their recent conference was the rise of the e-bike, the electric bike. I was just curious to see how that... Because, I mean, let's face it, in Glentrest, it's a pretty hardcore community. Lots of very, very keen mountain bikers go there. How do they view the use of e-bikes? Ed Sheet is Mountain Bike Development Officer for the Tweed Valley.
At a conference, I think it was interesting, the industry themselves were saying that the uptake of e-bikes is by people who have never previously cycled is the key market here, and it's getting people into the sport as a facilitator to the sport. It's not necessarily lazy mountain bikers taking them up, it's people who have never done it before, and maybe a year or two later, the idea is they'll maybe not want to use an e-bike anymore, they'll want, you know, the freedom and lightweight of a normal bike, and they'll switch back. And I think that's a great way of getting more people into the sport.
They definitely have a place, and they're great for stuff like rehabilitation if you've had an injury, or if you want to extend your cycling career into your later years when maybe you thought it was unachievable. So the more people riding and the more people on bikes, the better as far as we're concerned.
I also think that e-bikes actually give us a tremendous opportunity for innovation as well. We're really keen to that we extend the benefits of mountain biking into growing Scottish companies, growing businesses, the economic contribution that can make. And e-bikes have a lot of potential for innovation. There's going to be massive growth in the industry of bringing people into the sport and doing things. Scotland is a great testing ground as well. We want to encourage businesses over to do it. Around the conference, actually, we had an innovation summit as well, where we brought over with some of the biggest companies in the world working with Cycle Industries Europe. And a big focus of that innovation summit was e-bikes.
I think with e-bikes there are some issues that will need to be looked at as well in terms of where people will start to access, but certainly we've heard of European examples of where I found this amazing, that e-bikes have been taking people up hills to a place where they can't then get back down because they've not got the technical skill and ability to ride those trails back down, so they're taking the chairlifts back down to the base.
Which, so they're cycling uphill and take the chairlift down.
It's amazing to think that this happens, but it does. And the same in Scotland in terms of accessing some of our wilder, remoter regions. You can have people out there on a bike that, you know, gets them to these places, but they're not maybe experienced and used to being in those environments. And certainly there's challenges and issues that I think we will certainly have to look at in the coming years around that.
Yeah, we have to look at that. We have to look at the, you know, if people can go faster, can get into areas going uphill faster as well, can our trails cope with that as well and do these things as well. So we have to look at the sustainability of e-bikes as well and things. But there's generally probably more positives than issues that we need to mitigate against. Yeah.
I think what's great about this sport is the fact that, you know, Scotland is covered in trails, it's covered in facilities, there's lots of enthusiasm out there. You don't need to spend a fortune. You could buy, you know, a second-hand bike reasonably cheaply, and it's all the fun of the fair.
That's it. It's accessible to anybody, and e-bikes help that. But equally, if you have an older bike, if you've got a rigid bike, a single-speed bike, there's somewhere you can ride in Scotland and get out and experience the outdoors.
Hi, I'm Professor Gary Florida James from the Mountain Bike Centre of Scotland and Edinburgh Napier University.
And, so forgive me, I haven't seen an e-bike mountain bike, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Just describe this thing.
It's a big travel bike. This thing can go up the hills fairly steadily, but also then you can then take it down any of the trails that we have here in the Glentrest and in underneath them quite comfortably because of the amount of travel that's on it. So you'll see it's a big, hefty-looking bike, etc., and that's to be able to absorb all of the bumps and the shocks that it'll take on the descents.
And is that the battery there?
Yeah, so the big lump that you see in the middle is the battery. It's quite a heavy piece because overall, with having the front forks and having all the shock at the rear, etc., it's a heavier bike than you would see probably looking at a road bike or a commuter bike. I suppose the difference for us between a normal mountain bike and the e-bike is that because you've got this power unit through, then it will grind down the drivetrain much quicker than a normal bike. So that was really keen to see how we can improve the longevity of the drivetrain. So what that means is then I have to hopefully spend less money on chains and sprockets, etc.
Say you were to take that bike from here, to the foot of the hill, etc., to the top of the hill, how many times could you do it in one battery charge?
If you put it in its lowest setting, so it's got three settings. It's got an eco mode. On this particular one, it's got an eco mode, a trail mode, and a boost mode. So if you put it in the eco mode, you can be up and down. Probably you get five runs out of it.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is with an e-bike that there's misconceptions with the e-bike is that it's not a motorbike. You actually, it's a pedal assist. So the more you put in, the more you get out of it. So if you leave it in the lowest setting and you pedal hard, etc., you'll be able to go as far as you would in a normal bike and that bit more just with that assist.
We were talking about this earlier. What's the evidence to suggest that once somebody's invested, probably presumably heavily in one of these things, and got the fun out of it, that at some stage you think, you know what, I'm man enough or woman enough now that I'm going to give up with the e-assistance and I'm just going to go with a bare bike?
I'd say I'm the perfect example of it. So I was having some issues within the last year, just health issues. I was really struggling on my normal bike, so I got myself onto an e-bike. The assistance allowed me to get back out to basically, I suppose, create a bit of time and space within my head to make me enjoy getting back out biking again. And then that progressively led me then to come back onto my normal bike. So the e-bike, yes, I use it, but not near as much as I used to. And I'm just back on to being able to swap between the two. So on a particular weekend, if I've had a short, only got a small amount of time, I'll jump on the e-bike, gets me out. And it's that whole thing about the well-being as well. So it does, getting outdoors and getting out on the bike does something to the brain that we're starting to understand a bit more now. And then that encourages me to go down the other bike and it's not quite as hard. So we will see that. And some of the stuff that we will be looking at within the Mountain Bike Centre of Scotland is not just about the economic development side, but it is around about that health and the well-being, and particularly the use of e-bike and doing that. So with our colleagues in developing mountain biking in Scotland, we've already seen that in action. We've had, you know, we have had groups out and on mixed groups in terms of normal bikes and e-bikes. It just means that people can get out together.
I feel bad about dragging it back, because I mean, there are obviously manifest health benefits and mental health benefits to, you know, to getting out in the outdoors. Yeah. Dragging it back to cost, but how pricey are these things?
These are about £3,500 worth. So yes, that's a lot of money. But if you look at it in the context of the bike that it's based on, so with a normal mountain bike, that's kind of around about what some people pay. What we will look to, and we had this discussion today, is see if we can get the costs down. And the costs will come down as the technology moves forward, etc., I think, to make it so that people can actually access them. To me, I look at it as an uplift vehicle. That's exactly what it is. So some people will, you know, can go to the Alps and they can get on a ski lift, or we can go down into Innerleithen and where they run a vehicle uplift. For me, I just use this now.
Professor Garant Florida James of the Mountain Bike Centre of Scotland and Heriot Watt University. And I have to say, I liked the look of the bike, but £3,500?
Yeah, you can get a lot cheaper than that. You can go down to £400, £500, they'll get you a bike. Not as good as that one, obviously, but it'll get you up the hill.
Yeah,
it'll be a lot heavier as well. It's just when you get into carbon fibre, it's going to get expensive.
I was intrigued by it, and when he said this is not a motorbike, you know, basically the electric component of it will assist you.
Yeah.
You kind of need to pedal at the same time.
Yeah, because what it is, there's illegal American ones in Britain.
Illegal American e-bikes.
Yeah, so they're not restricted. A legal bike, you have to pedal it, and it's restricted to about 15 mile an hour. The illegal ones, it's just like an electric motorbike, and you can get up to 30, 40 mile an hour in one, whether I'd want to be in one at that speed.
See, I tried something a few years ago. It was an electric scooter, like a Vespa.
Yeah.
You know, and it looked fantastic. And as soon as they said what it was, I thought, ooh, I want one. But as often happens with these things, you sat in it and it was curiously disappointing because it didn't make the right noise.
Well, if you got a wee tape recorder in your head,
it's just an angry frog. About 3 years ago, there was tremendous flooding associated with Storm Frank. Now, basically, it tore through Aberdeenshire particularly, caused a lot of damage in Ballater because the town flooded, essentially, and it took out a lot of the suspension bridges across the Dee, which is, to be honest, iconic. And at the time, the damage was so bad, I think a lot of people thought, well, certainly I was one of them, well, that's them away.
Yeah, but they're actually being taken over this week. Donald McPherson is the bridges manager for Aberdeenshire, and he oversaw the project of this delightful bridge quite close to Ballater.
It's an icon of its time. It's of a family of suspension bridges developed in Aberdeen, but sold throughout the world, and we're very proud of it.
So they got the one design and it worked, so it went around the world.
Absolutely. It was ahead of its time. It was based on the Harper technology, and then this one was developed by James Abernethy, also an Aberdeen foundry. So it's a combination of different techniques come together to produce a significant span, 180 feet. So that's a long span bridge for its time.
It's like a mini Forth Road bridge.
It is. The technology is what you would find on the new Queens Ferry Crossing. The Queens Ferry Crossing is a development of this wire rope technology, so it's a sort of starter point.
And it's just bolted or riveted together, isn't it? Little bits of metal.
Yep, a lattice framework, a lattice deck, providing the stiffness that you need. But as you'll see later, it's really wobbly, so take care.
And it was presented to the public originally?
It was. It was Alexander Gordon. That's a local lad. He made good down in London. He was a brewer. He moved to Kent. But when he was a young man, he witnessed a drowning tragedy here. A young married couple unfortunately drowned, and he made a pledge at that time that if he made any money, he would build a suspension bridge here. And lo and behold, when later in life, he was able to fulfil that pledge.
And erected and all this, because I'm reading it off the plaque, 1892, so it's been here a fair old while.
It has. It's done really well. We've had different incidents here. There was a plane crash during World War II that hit the bridge, so it was been repaired since then, and we repaired it again in 2015 before Storm Frank, and then it got damaged during Storm Frank, that's us.
How badly? Well, let's go in the bridge a wee bit. How badly was it damaged?
It was significantly badly damaged. The water had reached the deck of the bridge, and of course when it is that extent of flood, it's carrying trees, huge big trees, and they crashed into the bridge at two locations, severely twisting the metalwork, twisting the deck. So it was a case of trying to pull it back out together again and get it back into shape.
Did you think it was going to get redone at that point? Because presumably, you know, times are hard, cash is limited.
When we first saw it, and we did some estimates to take the bridge deck off, put it back in again, and it was coming in at about £750,000, which even for a bridge of this significance is a lot of money to spend. But we were able to sit down, think about it, work with a contractor to come up with a lot cheaper solution, which made it viable, but we were never sure whether it would actually work or not until we started.
So did you have to take it off-site, or did they come here?
No, they came here. It was all done on-site, all done in situ. We were working from October onwards, so it was weather-dependent, but we were lucky with the weather as well, so that helped.
But you're working with kind of over 100-year-old technology. Was it difficult to find the skills to make it work?
Well, we were happy to use Maury Blast of Mosthodloch because they were experienced in suspension bridges, old suspension bridges. So we'd seen the work that they had done in other bridges, and we were confident that if anyone could do it, they could do it. So
you suggested it's a significant bridge. Why is it so special?
Within the locality, it's special because it's on the crown of the Seven Bridges Walk. It's or the centre point. It crosses the river at the furthest point out from Ballater. It's a circular walk, very popular walk, both with tourists and the locals, but also because it sits nicely in the environment. It really stands out. It's a special environment, but the bridge fits in so nicely.
So there's a lot of things coming together, architecture, the evolution of the land, and the fact it's a great recreational facility.
Yes, absolutely. And it's always interesting to get the comments back from people. They enjoy doing the Seven Bridges Walk. It's a nice distance. You can start in Ballater, finish at the new station, which is another iconic building.
So when this was down, presumably people wanting the decent walk It wasn't an option.
No, it was all barriered off. And round here, to walk the Dee Valley, there's only a very few options. You can go up the hills, but if you wanted to stay low, especially when the weather's poor, then you were really restricted. So to get this one open again, it's a good one for the winter.
But you've still more to do.
We've still another bridge to do, Cambus of May.
Is it the same style as this?
It is exactly the same style, the same fabricator, Abernethy, and also the Harper design. That's more badly damaged, but we think we have got a chance. Been successful, this one, the lessons learnt, we're putting our minds to that one now.
So will that make that one cheaper then?
Not necessarily, no. Because it's more extensively damaged, I think that one will be more expensive, and we still have to secure the funding for that. But this is a good pointer, so it should be easier to secure that funding if we know that it's possible.
I suppose when you get that kind of public acclaim for this delightful wee bridge, it kind of puts the onus on people to find the funding for the Cambus of May.
Oh, absolutely, yes, yep. It's part of the history of this area, and to lose the history is not something that we want to promote, so we're always be looking at ways to fix it. It's just getting the timing right.
So you get much reaction from local people?
We got a very good reaction when we announced that we were able to reopen it again. With the number of people that say they'll get back out and do the Seven Bridges Walk, is very encouraging. So that should be good for Ballater and get Ballater more towards what it was before Stormfront.
Donald McPherson there, bridge manager for Aberdeenshire Council. And great that that bridge is back on its feet again.
Yeah, and I didn't realise, I mean, I kind of noted vaguely as I've driven past, they all look similar. I didn't realise they were all identical. Uh-huh. And that was the foundation of things like the Golden Gate and the Fourth Road Bridge and all these iconic bridges around the world. It's a great story, a great programme to be done there, I think.
When we were a manufacturing nation, you could go into a catalogue and things like that, and I don't know, for all I know, maybe you still can. But, you know, if you wanted to build a railway station, all those little iron, cast iron finials and things like that, and the gewgaws and sort of all the fancy bits, you could order offline.
Yeah.
And somebody in Britain would make it and send it out to you, wherever it was in the world. Ditto all those tin huts, you know, the corrugated iron sheds and things, yeah, all around the world. What's the name of the bridge? It was Paul Hollock?
Paul Hollock Bridge, yeah.
Paul Hollock Bridge.
But okay. There's something, the thing that they did in the foundries, they put a plaque on all these things, whether it was a gate or an oil tank or whatever, and they're just fascinating. Because it'll be a date, the maker's name, and where it was made. Or maybe it's just me.
No. It's something that catches my attention too. Sometimes we have to work really hard on this podcast to find the right interviewee, to find the right person in the right place at the right time, and other times you just kind of trip over them.
Yeah, I was talking about the number of swans that were around my neck of the woods in Banffshire, and I speculated there were hundreds and possibly even thousands up there. You disagreed.
It's a reasonable assumption.
You're
probably exaggerating.
Healthy scepticism, but yeah. You know, we were in the car park doing the programme, chatting about swans, and then coming sailing into the car park was Richard Humpage. Now, Richard's in charge of a lot of East Coast nature reserves for the RSPB, and the very man to ask the question about swans. He was actually in to talk to our sister channel, Radio 4, on that very subject. So when he emerged blinking into the daylight from the studio,
we jumped on him.
Oh, we're talking about hooper swans.
What's the difference between hooper swans and mute swans? Do mute swans make a noise?
Mute swans do make a noise, but not very often and not very loud, whereas the hooper swans are very vocal as they're flying around. They're about the same size as a mute swan, but have a yellow and black beak rather than an orange and black beak.
Now, I live in Banffshire, and over the past 3-4 weeks, I've seen... I mean, I looked out in the field the other day and I thought, goodness me, there must be at least 1,000. The whole field was white. Am I right? I mean, I can be exaggerating a wee bit.
Well, I didn't see the field full that you were looking at, but certainly at Strathbeg we had 1,600 swans there back in October.
They make the most fabulous sound. I mean, it's a slightly unearthly sound, hooper swans.
Yeah, it's a kind of eerie sound, isn't it? Not quite a honking noise as they fly over. It's a fantastic noise, though, isn't it?
Pretty much the sound of winter, though, isn't it? It's like the arrival of the geese.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. I mean, they come back at a similar time to the geese.
Come back from where?
They breed in Iceland, so the birds are just newly arrived. They use Strathbeg, if you like, as a motorway service station. So they'll come back, they'll fly non-stop from Iceland, they'll stop at Strathbeg for a couple of days, feed up, and then they'll disperse wider. And, you know, we're down to probably 700 or 800 hoopers there now, so half what we did have.
Will they stay there permanently?
They'll be there until March or so, and then they'll all head north again for another hopefully successful breeding season.
Last time I saw them, they were on the wing, and I was actually working outside one of our outbuildings, and I heard the wings from outside, and they had the I don't know what it is, the pinions, whatever it is, they, I mean, it's like a flying barn door. Just, no, there's more of a sort of, it's like almost a creaking noise that you actually get.
They're massive, aren't they? I mean, each bird weighs about 10 kilos, and what you're hearing is literally the wind going through the flight feathers as they're pressing down really hard so they can stay up in the air. They're one of the world's largest flying birds, heaviest flying birds, so you know, it takes quite a lot of effort to get up. One of the things I really like about the mute swans as well, as opposed to the geese that come around, they fly much lower when they're here with us. So you do actually hear that noise of the wind going through the wings. It's fantastic.
I was looking at my kitchen window last week, and as you say, they're very low. There was a whole pile of them got up, and I'm looking at this thing. This is going to come through the window. It's quite a scary, because they're, you know, big things. They're really low. They're quite impressive.
I mean, we often see them as they're taken off from the lock. They have to make extra effort just to get up above a fence, and then they drop back down again. They are flying that low.
It's kind of like a Wellington bomber, isn't it?
Yes, it can be.
Why have we got so many? I mean, I've lived in my house for 30-odd years, and you would see one or two. And then 3 years ago, suddenly there's big flocks. And this year, it seems even bigger flocks.
They do move around quite a lot. So it might be that whilst the UK population is going up, what you're seeing is just local movements. But it's true to say that the numbers in the UK as a whole have tripled over the last few years, yes.
Was that just lack of persecution, or are they just finding conditions better for them?
It's hard to know exactly. Milder winters are certainly going to help. So, you know, one of the limiting factors is going to be food during the winter. So they come down and enjoy our mild winters. And they're doing really well, so it puts them in good breeding condition when they get back up to Iceland.
If Ewan was correct in his assessment, there was 1,000 swans in the field next door, and not for a moment saying he was, because he does exaggerate, but say he was, and these birds, you know, say there was 1,000 birds and they're 10 kilograms each, that's 20 tonnes of swans sitting in a field. What do they eat?
At this time of year, they're eating a lot of grass and spilt grain from the stubble fields. They also like potatoes. So you'll often see them in harvested potato fields picking up all the little spuds that the farmers haven't picked up.
Unlike geese, which you could see them coming, hundreds of them, thousands of them, they all descend en masse, they seem to come in wee groups of twos and threes and fours, and then they see the big mass of white and then they all join in. Are these family groups, or any indication what they are?
Certainly when they arrive back in the autumn, the birds come in family groups, yes. So you'll see mum and dad and three or four youngsters. And then as the winter goes on, those family groups are less cohesive, if you like, and they'll start going out with their mates rather than with mum and dad. And then at the end of the winter, that'll be that, and they'll be totally independent then.
One thing I've never quite been sure about, obviously you can shoot geese. What's the law regarding swans? Do they belong to the crown?
That's a story that everyone says.
This is an urban myth, is it?
To be honest, I don't know. They are protected. Nobody is allowed to shoot them under any circumstances. Whether they all belong to the Queen or not, or whether she just claims the mute swans, I can't answer that one. I'm not a lawyer.
Could we enter the situation, though, where they could become a pest? If you've got 1,400 swans in a field going through tatties, that's potentially quite a big impact.
Yes, you're right. It could be potentially quite a large impact. When they're grazing, we estimate that there's about 9 or 10 swans to a sheep and 10 sheep to a cow. So 100 swans is about a cow's worth of grazing. As you say, a significant impact. And there are some areas down in the Montrose Basin, for example, where they employ swan scarers to actually go round and scare the swans out of the farmers' fields because of the impact they're having.
Can I just bring you back to the business of whether you're allowed to shoot swans or protected and belonging to the Crown and things like that? Years ago, I took part in a television programme on swan upping on the Thames in Henley and I think it was Henley and Thames.
Have you?
Yeah.
What's upping?
In Nottinghamshire.
Right, well, explain what swan upping is.
Well, we round up the swans. At the end of the breeding season, they drop all of their flight feathers, so they become flightless for 6 weeks or so whilst they're growing new feathers. And during that time, they're relatively easy to round up, and then we can tag them and ring them and find out where they go and dispersal patterns and so on.
I've done the counting down at Montrose and down at Calaverick. It is a great spectacle, and the arrival of these swans is just a great sight in Scotland in the winter.
Oh, it is. It's a fantastic time with the swans coming back and the geese. Spring is always my favourite time, but autumn, with the arrival of these birds coming back now, is running a very close second. It's a fantastic time.
Richard Humpage from the RSPB there, and the Hooper Swans. And sadly, that's all we've got time for the podcast.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful birds, and that noise carrying across the fields in winter is just a delight.
Yeah. As I was saying when we were talking to Richard, just the sound of swans' wings, that's just something about it. It really gets my attention every time I hear it. Lovely. Anyway, thanks very much for downloading the podcast. We'll be back with another one next week from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen. Thanks for listening.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.